House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Friday, February 5th. There's overflow in room 350. Okay, first item, we are going to carry over 3601 to next week, so we will not be having a hearing on that today. And we'll open today's meeting with a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 3670.
Great, just call them and open this.
Okay, and could I have Vi Beatty and Sandy Rorick, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3670 grants rulemaking authority to Oregon State Police to clarify registration requirements for sex offenders. It declares emergency effective on passage. There is no fiscal impact or revenue impact with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please go ahead in any order you wish and identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vi Beatty. I'm the sex offender registry manager for the state of Oregon with Oregon State Police. Basically, the rulemaking authority granted to Oregon State Police through this bill would allow us to clarify, for uniformity's sake, what the statutes currently mean, how they should be applied statewide by all of our partners. It's simply to bring that unification throughout the state.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Rorick, and I am a parole and probation officer with Multnomah County, and I specialize in supervising sex offenders, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the statewide Sex Offender Supervision Network in endorsing this bill, House Bill 3670. We feel, as Vi said, that this would clarify the language that's used by the various agencies that work with the state police and register sex offenders and work with the registration and notification of sex offenders. We feel that it would be beneficial.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Yeah. Why, most agencies have commissions and boards that have public hearings when they have administrative rules they're going to be adopted. What kind of a process are you going to use?
The state requires for rulemaking authority that an advisory committee with all the interested partners be put together. So we'll be contacting all the partners, both sides of the fence, basically, juvenile as well as adult, to put these rules together and make sure that we apply them the way the legislature intended them to be applied. And then I believe the next process is that there has to be public hearings, at least three throughout the state. So we'll be scheduling those once the permanent rules are adopted by the advisory committee. And then we'll have the public hearings and just follow the state process.
Okay. That's fine. Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
I also have written letter.
Okay. We'll take that if you give that to staff. Though. Thank you very much. Okay. Close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3670.
It's good to give a record.
I'll accept a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, move that House Bill 3670 be moved to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 3670 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Krieger will be the carrier. On a hearing on public hearing on House Bill 3695 related to metal recycling. Representative Olson, would you like to introduce the bill?
If you want to introduce it, I think there's just a couple key points. We could actually describe it from here, and it would be really good to then have some input from the folks that are here representing different perspectives.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3695 eliminates the requirement that a scrap metal business be licensed to do business in the state of Oregon to comply with the metal theft law, changes the applicable mental state to knows or has good reason to know throughout the measure, limits the reporting requirement for metallic wire from wire from which the insulation has been melted off, provides an affirmative defense for licensed motor carriers, and expands the law to ferrous metals. It declares an emergency effective on passage. We have a -1 amendment, and that allows a P.O. box to be used in a metal property record transaction instead of a physical address if the P.O. box is listed on a driver's license. We have a no revenue impact on the dash one and a minimal fiscal impact on the dash one. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, there were a number of issues that, I mean, and to be truthful with you, the district attorney's office throughout the state, as well as different law enforcement agencies, and a number of folks just in general, specifically the industry themselves, the recyclers, are struggling with Senate Bill 570. And the intent of trying to move forward with some amendments was to simplify some areas. There were some things most definitely needed to be corrected, as Anna just mentioned. But now that we've moved forward with what we have here today, there's still a couple issues that seem to be, even within this amendment, or within this bill, 3695, that needs to be kind of flushed out even more. And this is a great opportunity for those involved with the industry to be able to just step up and hear their voice on the different issues.
Thank you very much. I'll call first Mike Kirschman, Tom Gallagher, and Chris Alexander. I think it's Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing Schnitzer Steel. Thank you for having me back for my third annual visit on this bill. It's been one of the highlights of my sessions so far. This is the third time that we've done a metal theft bill, and each time we've done the bill, our industry has been less and less included in the deliberations. Our advice and input has been less and less recognized and sought, and I can tell you on this time, I didn't see any of these amendments, although some members had told me about them, until the bill was actually printed. I had some hallway discussions. I appreciate those. So we're getting a little frustrated about the whole process here. One of the biggest frustrations we have is there's no real data being collected. We don't know what the impacts of the two rounds of metal theft bills that you passed. We have anecdotal stories, and I think they're important, but we've never been able to do something we've asked for, which is a compilation of real data on metal theft so we can see if what we're doing is actually working. I'll give you an example of what I mean. One of the things we said last time is we're getting less metal. Metal is being moved out of state. We know it's going out in international containers. We know that there are truckloads for hire carriers hauling metal up and down the freeway. And you put some legislation in last time saying they can't do that, and you have fixed some of that in this bill. To the best of our knowledge, there's nobody pulling these trucks over. There's nobody checking them at weigh stations. We have statutory restriction there, a requirement on people. But we're pretty sure that a lot of the metal, especially the stolen metal, is simply being moved out of state to Idaho and other places where there are none of the safety guards that you put in on our businesses. So our businesses aren't getting it. It's moving somewhere else. The third thing I'd say is, and my people will talk about it, is this is negatively impacting the businesses that do recycling in the state. These are some of the original recycling businesses in the state. We've been recycling ferrous and non-ferrous metal for over 100 years. And it is having an impact on how people can bring in small amounts of metal and how what they're having to go through at the recycling places. That's causing the recycling to move somewhere else, which is outside the safety net that you've constructed. So rather than me giving generalities here, let me have some of the members of the industry talk about what has happened since we passed the last bill and what we look forward to with these amendments. And I'm specifically focusing on including non-ferrous metals in the bill.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Kirschman with Schnitzer Steel Industries. I'm the commercial manager for the Oregon region, and just want to hit a couple of highlights what Mr. Gallagher has spoken about, and just kind of paint a picture from our viewpoint what we see and what we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. A couple positive things of these changes just wanted to mention before I get into the ferrous metal issues. One where you have changed or decided to accept P.O. boxes on a valid driver's license or a valid state ID. It is beneficial and a good change. We accept that, and one of the main reasons why, because we have had an increased level of return checks. Obviously, the biggest issue with this bill has been the 3-day hold on checks and payments to non commercial accounts for any non-ferrous metals and any commercial property that's ferrous metals. And we have increased our returned and missing checks. We have some issues with that. And so the P.O. box, if we can send to a P.O. box, that's going to alleviate some of the problems that we've been seeing just in the last 35 days that we've been in conjunction with this bill. That kind of leads me to the next issue of probably my main point is really questioning the necessity of this addition to include all ferrous metals. The bill as it stands is very inclusive on ferrous commercial metal property. Stating from the bill, in fact, I could go down, but in lieu of time, I'll just name a few. A pole, fixture, component, utility access cover, manhole covers, traffic safety device, including guardrails, rotor bridges, historic site grave, statue, monument, agricultural implement, forestry implement, logging operation. It's very inclusive of commercial property. And as it stands, we are conducting our operations to inspect these properties, and I think we do a very good job as an industry and these companies as a whole. We do a good job at identifying potential stolen property on the commercial side. Now, switching that to include all ferrous material really is going to limit, and I believe very strongly that it will reduce the recycling rate in all of Oregon. And I'll name a couple reasons why. We're talking about identifying stolen property for ferrous metal. Number one, there's a difference between the value, obviously, of ferrous metal and non-ferrous metal. You have copper that's roughly, say, $3 a pound. You have steel or ferrous metal that's anywhere from 5 to 10 to 12 cents a pound. The value of the metal property, number one, makes a huge deterrent for ferrous material to be stolen. Number two, we have had less than 10% of the CICP reports in the last 6 months. We have less than 10% is ferrous material. I was just pulling that out. The CICP is the Construction Industry and Prevention Coalition or program that has it's kind of a watchdog and works very closely with the Portland Police Department. And we receive emails and notifications of any issues that they're working on currently and any reported stolen property. It's very efficient. It's just in time. As soon as they have the information, we receive that. And so according to the last 6 months, the actual numbers that we received from Schnitzer were about 54 cases in the last 6 months, of which 48 were non-ferrous material, and 8 were ferrous material, which included commercial property, commercial type of property, not obsolete scrap metal. And I just want to make a distinction there in our industry to pull out and see that there's a couple different types of scrap metal. There's obsolete scrap, your washer, your dryer, the stuff that's been sitting out in farms, and then there's either new production or commercial property. If you include on this bill the obsolete scrap, your washers, your dryers, and you require us as an industry to hold checks for 3 days, number one, it's not just 3 days. That's when we mail it out. We generally tell our customers this month it's going to be 7 to 10 days, and we've had many issues with the mail getting held up and them not getting payment. It really deters any incentive for small peddlers, small businesses, sole proprietors that don't fall under the commercial category, commercial account category. Really deters any economic viability to, on a smaller scale, to recycle that washing machine. 200 pounds at 5 cents a pound, that's $20. If they have to wait 10 days to get that and they have to haul it down, it's going to end up in their backyard still. And you're going to see, some environmental issues. You're going to see less recycling. And I guarantee the recycling rate will go down. It's really a deterrent overall for the recycling industry. And I don't think the state of Oregon wants to do that. The very related issue is when our neighboring state, obviously Washington and especially in the Portland region, they do not have as strict of bills there, and that material is going to go north because of the proximity. There are companies there are companies that are located in both states, and that material is going to be forced out of the state, if not into Washington, over to Idaho, down to California, where they do not have as strict of stringent standards. And we feel so serious about it. Schnitzer Steel obviously has been in this and was originated out of the Portland region. We have, including our joint venture, six locations, including Portland, Eugene, White City, Bend, Salem. We feel real serious about this, that long term, if this is the case and we are seeing this business being pushed outside of the state, then we may have to look at possibly looking at the Port of Vancouver and see what the opportunities are there. Not to mention the, you know, from a fiscal policy standpoint of, you know, the tax revenue that scrap metal is going to produce. I don't think a lot of the general public realizes the types of tax revenues that this industry produces. I can throw out general numbers of the, on a monthly basis, hundreds of thousands of tons in the state of Oregon alone that are recycled and that are moved, and you're talking a lot of tax revenue. So we really feel strongly about that. To echo Mr. Gallagher's statement as far as the enforcement, we definitely feel like we are going over and above what is necessary as an industry in helping law enforcement. We have a very good internal program, at least at Schnitzer, and I think other companies as well. But we feel that pressure has been overly burdening on us and our operations. And we think that, to what Mr. Gallagher stated as far as the enforcement, it's really, that's where the answer is. The enforcement, if the smaller businesses aren't enforced to abide by these rules, then the larger companies are going to suffer the most, because we are going to abide by these laws, these more stricter laws. So really, that's the gist, and we really feel strongly that it will, over time and even short term, reduce the recycling rate in Oregon. And we don't think it's necessary. It's very restrictive already on the commercial side of things. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, my name is Chris Alexander. I'm the general manager of Schnitzer Steel. I've been in the recycling industry just under 20 years. I'm going to speak from notes today, and I apologize. I just learned of this change about midweek, even that this hearing was going on, so I'd like to address some of the things. Tom and Mike have both addressed many of the things that I would like to speak to, so I'll speak more casually. I'll represent the company as well as myself and a church group that I work with that tries to recycle metals and clean people's yards up and help people out. Scrap theft is not new. It's been around for years. The first weeks, days that I was in the industry 20 years ago, we certainly looked at and were diligent. I was working for another company before Schnitzer. All the recycling companies have looked at not buying things that have been stolen. The original bill that was put forth restricting some of the non-ferrous purchases has been very effective. There's some very good things in there. We, as a company and as individuals, we're diligent. We train our people to watch for scrap metals. We ask questions first. We look at the product that comes in. We're very cautious and careful, number one, not to buy or support criminals, but also not to end up with materials or have our own materials stolen as well. Potential transactions that are represented, as Mike was saying, are very minuscule as it relates to non-ferrous versus ferrous metals. But even more so than that, the percentage of transactions at all that may include scrap theft are certainly less than 1% of, or a tenth of 1%. There are very few. This law will cause potentially several things, and Mike addressed some of them as far as the business going outside of our state. The recycling numbers will drop. The people that Recycling is one of these pyramid businesses where the little people bring stuff into the medium-sized people, and it works its way up to a large recycling program. You'll be taking one level of that out. The little people will go away. Some of the smaller businesses, in fact, one within a half a mile of us has gone out of business here recently because it's just not economic to recycle anymore. The incentives are small. The recycling business is a marginally profitable business. There's so much that goes into getting the materials to the marketplace. But what will happen is this: if recycling stops, then there's a burden on the taxpayers. The material has to go somewhere. It either comes in the form of neighborhood complaints because somebody's yard gets junky, or it goes to the landfill and it fills the landfill up before it's supposed to be, its life cycle is finished. And eventually, 10, 15, 20 years from now, we'll be in landfills having to harvest this metal back out because it ended up going in there mistakenly. It's going to put, like I said, the small dealers out of business and those mom and pops that just want to get rid of the washing machine on their front porch, you know, that's been sitting there, and like I said, the small cleanup businesses. It's going to send customers, the individual customers, to Washington. They're going to go there where it's easier to recycle. I believe the state of Oregon should be looking at ways to build businesses, not drive businesses away. As Mike said, we may have to look at going there ourselves in order to be able to compete on a level playing field. I believe that with our proximity to Washington, that indeed that's the only thing that we can do to be able to maintain business. It's going to cost jobs as we begin to downsize as recycling goes down. It'll cost jobs in our recycling yards in the six facilities that Mike spoke of, as well as our steel mill that is in McMinnville. Cascade Steel Mills is down there, and it's part of the life cycle of recycled metals. The biggest thing that it's going to do is it's going to thwart the efforts of this bill, and it's going to drive our ability to capture stolen materials, to recognize them and catch the people that are involved in it. It's going to take it to Washington, where they're not going to be diligent about finding out what's disappeared out of Oregon's businesses and recycling stream. It's a marginally profitable business, and again, the taxpayers are going to pay it. Now I want to speak, I've been speaking for Snitzer, I want to speak for the church group that I work with, and I used to work with Boy Scouts when I was in Alaska. It's wonderful to be able to go into an old folks' backyard and clean their yard up and collect all the materials and bring them in to be recycled. It's costly to do that. You have to be able to buy garbage bags and tools and this and that, and so we've always used the revenue from what we've made off the scrap to fund that program so that it wasn't a cost to the old folks, the senior citizens, or the less fortunate. Now, having to hold the checks, the amount of revenue is going to drop because Snitzer and the other recycling companies are going to have to pay less to pay for this program in-house. So all the economics of that are going to go down to the point that eventually it's just going to go away. You're not going to be able to see any of this small-level, small-scale recycling. We do understand the plight of the construction industry and the materials that they're losing. We're working diligently to help control that. We've been doing it for years long before there was legislation. We hope that you don't tie our hands any further with more rigid restrictions like those that are found in House Bill 3695.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any questions from the committee? I really appreciate your input. As you know, we're in a short session, and sometimes things get moving along before they're ready to move further, and your testimony will help us a lot in coming up with a
thank you for your time. Thank you.
Next, I'll call Bob Russell, Bill Whitman, and Jeff Steinfeld. And if it's already been said, we'd appreciate it. You know, we're listening and we're hearing what's being said, so we don't need to hear it 100 times. But please, I don't want to cut anybody off. Please go ahead and, in your choice of order, just identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell, representing the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I would like to speak exclusively to Section 4, which is the only part of the bill that has any impact on my industry. When Senate Bill 570 was passed last session, there was a requirement and that transporters of scrap metal would obtain a certificate that was designed by the Oregon State Police and carry that certificate in the truck. I don't believe that when that provision was put into Senate Bill 570 that people were thinking about my trucks, my folks. They were thinking about other folks that were transporting scrap. And they thought, if we look at on page 5, sub 5 of that section, says it is a defense to a charge of unlawfully transporting metal property. The person transporting the metal property is the owner of the property or an agent. And in fact, the drafters of 570 thought my folks, when they got were hired, were agents of the shipper. In fact, in our terminology, we think we are a bailee in possession, so we don't think we're quite an agent, but probably more importantly, when I called OSP and asked them if we were subject to this, they said absolutely. So from a practical standpoint, we were going to be subject to it. And so what the change does is it basically says that trucking companies that are regulated by the Department of Transportation are not subject to this specific requirement. So when you think one step further, when Mr. Gallagher mentioned earlier about for-hire trucking companies, for-hire trucking companies always have a bill of lading, which, as it happens, is the same information that is on the certificate that OSP has developed. And that's required under the Uniform Commercial Code. In last session, you guys did a bill on the UCC that dealt with bills of lading, warehouse receipts, and all the rest of that stuff. So all of my for-hire guys have that document, and that is accessible to law enforcement at any time, whether it be on highway at a way station or any place else, or whether it be at the trucking company's place of business. So in a sense, the certificate was redundant with documentation that already exists and is available to law enforcement. So I would urge your passage of Section 4. And I have no opinion about the rest of the bill.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Jeff Steinfeld, Far West Fibers. I've got kind of two separate things dealing with the same bill. Our company is the largest paper recycling company in Oregon. We primarily do paper off curbside. And the first effect this bill will have, or one thing that I'd like for you to consider, is to add in Section 5 an exemption for licensed refuse haulers. And an example of that would be a local garbage company setting a drop box down for, let's say, the Brooklyn neighborhood cleanup in southeast Portland. They tell the Brooklyn cleanup, we will haul it for X amount of money, but we'll minus the value of the ferrous metal in that drop box off of your bill. You will get the rest of the money, and they haul it. According to this, they have to have a metal transport certificate. They have to get the name of the people at the Brooklyn community cleanup. And so it puts a serious dent in recycling. Also, some garbage haulers in the future are considering adding a ferrous metal box to behind local businesses. With this law, they would have to document time, date, the person for every pickup on a route. Well, if you do a ferrous metal route that, let's say, it has 45 pickups, you're going to have the driver do 45 separate things on that route. And so for the first part of the bill, I'd strongly suggest that you'd add an exemption for licensed refuse haulers. For the second part, we have a small community recycling scrap yard in southeast Portland. We would probably be considered the smallest scrap yard in Portland. Primarily, it's a drop-off location for the public. We accept everything from plastic to crayons to books to apparel. One of the things we do to try and control the cost and make money there is we buy scrap metal. When you add ferrous to this bill, a really good example for us that just happened today is I had an older gentleman come in with a broken dishwasher. He wanted to get paid for this dishwasher. The dishwasher weighs 60 pounds. We would pay him $3.50. And yes, he actually pulled across the scale and we paid him $3.50. The problem with this bill is with our non-ferrous right now, it costs us $3 to make that check. Before the last bill came into effect, we're still using paper tickets at our southeast yard. We don't have a computer at the yard. And so now we're having a lady from our larger northeast facility that handles a lot of the paper recycling. We're having her drive to southeast every day, grab the tickets, and then go to our northeast yard and enter them. And we're fine with that for the non-ferrous. But when you add ferrous, the cost is $3 per ticket. Well, most of our ferrous items we buy or not most of them, but a substantial portion are a $3 to $5 item coming from the general public, not coming from a peddler or a small hauler, but from just local people bringing their materials in, and they want to get paid for that material. We would no longer be able to purchase that material. And I don't know if that would change having ferrous metal as a whole or having a minimum amount before this law takes into effect. But before we add ferrous to this, we need to explore that avenue and the recycling rates that causes, because a lot of these people won't recycle when they're the small haulers and stuff, or small local community people, or be able to bring it into our facility. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairman, board members. My name is Bill Whitman. I'm with Schnitzer Steel. A lot of the things that I had come forward to speak about today were covered a little earlier. As a further introduction of myself, I'm a third-generation Oregonian, born and raised in Klamath County, and I have many family members that are farmers and ranchers in southern Oregon and eastern Oregon, who are among those who can be impacted by this addendum. And looking at the scrap metal industry and the 40-plus years that I have been in it, and learning all of the facets of the collection system and actually being an active part in that working, I have never seen us get to a point where now recycling is not in the limelight anymore. These kind of actions, working towards that phantom meth dealer or whatever it is, can have very, very negative impacts on the recycling industry as a whole. As far as the ferrous materials go, there are very few situations that would have meth dealers dealing with that because of the relative value of the product. Substantially, as it was indicated earlier, copper's worth $3 a pound, where scrap metal may be worth a few cents a pound, not to mention gold, silver, and platinum. So that's basically all I wanted to say, is just get across that this is a very, very important bill before you that really deserves a lot of consideration. Okay.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony. Jeff Sloan, Jay Burcham, and those two right now.
Jeff will speak first.
Okay.
No, please. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Stone, Oregon Association of Nurseries. I'm not going to bear to repeat. I've submitted testimony in general support of trying to make the very good work that has been done by the 2007 and 2009 legislatures to deal with the issue of metal theft easier for law enforcement. And ultimately, we've heard today about some of the conflicts within the metal industry about the issues of ferrous and non-ferrous. I'll leave that to the metal industry to decide what is best for them. But overall, we're very pleased with the collaboration that has occurred over the last 2 years. You have regular meetings now with the metal recyclers and law enforcement to talk about issues of concern. You can't legislate that. It happens because we all came together as a coalition to put forward a bill that has had a lot of soul searching and not always unanimity. So I would stop there, Mr. Chair. I have enough in my testimony. Thank you for your time.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Stone. Thank you for your work on those committees as well.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Jay Burcham, Burcham's Metals, Albany, Oregon. I'm taking a little bit different approach. Currently, if you can visualize coming into my small business in Albany with, and you have done what some have mentioned today, cleaning up around your house, your property. If you brought in 500 pounds of steel, I could pay you immediately upon that delivery and that transaction. If you had 2 pounds of non-ferrous of any kind, I cannot pay you today. I will have a 3-day wait period on that. And that material could easily be less than $5. We sent out a check the other day for 52 cents. You can see my frustration. That is disappointing to me. And so I am for the combining of Ferris and non-Ferris from my perspective down I-5. But what you've been listening to this afternoon from Schnitzer's, and I don't know if there's other companies that will be testifying today or not behind me, but there comes a fairness of the people that you have listened to so far. Like Mr. Gallagher, I think he started out and said that Schnitzer's has been established for over 100 years. Cal Bag is represented, and I don't know if Mr. Leahy would confirm this or not, but they have been in business for approximately 100 years. I have been, well, my father started the business, but our business has been established for 50 years this year. And Metro Metals, formerly a couple other companies that merged, I don't know for sure, maybe 60 or 70 years. These are people that know this business, and they are concerned about fairness and perhaps driving across the river to someone else and someone being in a position to pay cash because their hands are tied here on this side of the river. I appreciate that, and I respect that. When I'm down in Albany, an hour and a half away from the Portland market, I look at it from a recycling perspective that I have people that are very much disturbed and irate that we can't combine these loads, like I had originally said. But you can't combine it for south of the metropolitan area of Portland. You can't do that. But I want to go on record stating that my heart's desire is that we would be able to blend these together. I struggle with it being successful, being able to do that statewide. But for my selfish desire, for my business, it would be a big benefit. I do have a concern, and I'm not prepared properly pertaining to the insulated copper wire situation that many utilities are concerned about. I am not a police officer, and my employees are not trained in law enforcement. But Mr. Chair, we too, as Chris has already mentioned, we too have trained our employees to do the best they possibly can to recognize something that is suspicious. We have a very good track record with our local law enforcement on working with them very closely and being very helpful. Currently in the SB 570, if an individual came in with 10 pounds of copper wire and they did not have documentation for proof of where that wire came from or in fact it was theirs, I am obligated under the law to contact local law enforcement, which in my case would be Albany PD, and I'd contact the detective there and tell him at the end of the day of all of my transactions of bare copper wire. And that is cumbersome for us, yes, but I don't want to just look at it just from my perspective. For law enforcement, as most of us know, law enforcement is stretched very thin, and they're trying to do a good job with few people and resources. And yet, here I'm adding more to their workload, and it's hard. We spent an hour and a half with the Albany Police Chief last week and the detective that I'm accountable to, and trying to work with them and trying not to sound like I'm crying wolf every time I have something that I need to report. So I believe that needs to be looked at, and I'm concerned about that. It's hard for someone in our line of work to know that insulated copper wire from perhaps a utility or an electrical contractor, that wire has in fact been stripped. But I can rightfully contact law enforcement because that material looks suspicious to me. And we can do that. But I struggle with that issue about being able to identify. Also, you know, excuse me, Representative Olson has stated earlier to simplify. All of us in this room are for that. And we do not want to discourage recycling. And no one at your, you know, on your committee is against recycling. This state has great pride in the steps that they have taken over decades to promote recycling. But as it's already been shared, we at Bertram's Metals have been faced, unfortunately, with people that are bogged down and they're intimidated with the current law. And they have stated to us that they will not recycle. Well, we don't want to hear that. We don't want to hear that from our perspective financially, of course, but just from the state perspective. So a lot involved for the committee, a lot involved on studying this, and I do not see where it will go through as quickly as it did originally with the unanimous vote in the House and the Senate. There's a lot to study here, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Brandon Wilson, Jason Hauer, Ewitz, Dave Barenberg, and Sergeant King.
You never know what can of worms you open up for businesses.
Good morning, Chair Barker and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Jason Huser with the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I think I can be pretty brief in my testimony. First off, UEB and many other utilities were supporters of Senate Bill 570. It was a comprehensive bill. I don't think we're surprised that there's some cleanup that's necessary, so it's not surprising that we're dealing with that. For the most part, we think the cleanup seems very reasonable. I think there's one item that we do want to flag for you from the utility perspective, and also law enforcement will have some additional input on that. In Section 2 of the bill, page 3, lines 19 through 25, there's a deletion of existing language from 570. That language required metal recyclers, anytime they purchased any metal wire that had insulation removed by any kind of method, to report that to law enforcement within 24 hours. The substitute language would actually narrow the scope only to apply that reporting requirement to metal with the insulation burned off or melted. We find that problematic because there's a lot of evidence that metal thieves do remove the insulation by other methods than burning or melting, basically stripping it by hand or tool. That's a big concern for us, but I think you have a document that went around in front of you. Utilities are trying not to be helpless victims of metal theft. We are trying to harden targets and protect our metal equipment as an asset. This is, what you have in front of you is a strategy employed by, I think, 6 to 7, maybe a little more than that, Southern Willamette Electric Utilities. We've tried to paint our insulated wire different colors and coat it so that law enforcement and metal recyclers can quickly call the appropriate utility to find out what they've lost. It's a good strategy. We would hate to see that undermined by a change where stripped wire was not being reported to local law enforcement, and we would urge you to keep the existing language from 570 intact instead of the substitute language. And I'll turn it over to my colleagues here. I can take questions later.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Wilson.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Brenda Wilson. I'm the Governmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene, and I'll also try to keep this brief. Again, appreciate the opportunity for being able to present our concerns. We agree with Jason here in EWEB that we we also, the City of Eugene, was in support of Senate Bill 570, and we participated in a work group that helped put those provisions together. One of the provisions that the City of Eugene had requested was this very provision in Section 23C that is being removed. For some reason, in the Eugene area, burning and melting of insulation off of wire is not the preferred stripping method of choice. Our Eugene Police Department have found several insulation stripping operations while investigating other crimes. A particular example that I bring up quite often is a private landowner came across on the back part of his property. He had very heavily wooded, very steep property where it looked like metal thieves had tied large amounts of wire. He found piles and piles of insulation on his property. They had tied the wire to trees, had connected the insulation to some sort of heavy vehicle given the ruts in his property, and driven down the hill to strip the insulation off. And our police are finding this more and more. Generally, our police department is reporting that the burned wire that they are finding is typically a fine telecommunications wire where the insulation cannot be easily stripped off manually or by operation. We also, as the City of Eugene, are not being helpless victims. We've taken several measures to prevent wire being stripped from our bike paths, our traffic signals, our community. We've put concrete blocks on top of junction boxes, and it just doesn't seem to be stopping them. People are hooking up trucks with equipment to remove these 500-pound concrete blocks off of junction boxes, and they're destroying the equipment. It costs several times the amount of the value of the wire to replace. And so we are also taking steps. Removing this particular provision, we believe we will see an increase in the wire theft in our community, and we are happy to work with Representative Olson and anyone else to address these concerns. We understand the burden that businesses, especially the recycling businesses, are under, but local governments are also under a significant amount of fiscal pressure right now, and anything that we can do to prevent metal theft is what we would ask. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barenberg.
Yeah, Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Dave Barenberg from the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations, and with me is Sergeant Troy King, who heads the unit that investigates metal theft for the city, and also in the audience is Detective Mark Georgioff, who has the distinction of having investigated more metal theft cases than anybody in the state, and they're here as resources if the committee has any questions on the practical law enforcement aspects of the issue. We just want to add our voice to those of Mr. User and Ms. Wilson that we would like the changes in Section 23C of this bill to go away. We'd like to maintain the status quo of 570 and be able to implement the wire provisions as is. We also think that as we are just beginning to implement this law, which we want to again thank you for having passed and the leadership of Representative Olson and Representative Barton and putting together, that there may be some other issues that we will want to come in 2011 to address, and we'll work with our business and other law enforcement partners so that we can process things and come in with, hopefully, you know, once again, a fairly consensus bill. And I'm happy, as is the sergeant, to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, so just close the public hearing.
Was there anybody else want to testify on this bill? Okay, I'll close the public hearing on this bill. Representative Olson, if you'll continue your diligent work with the industry to come up with a bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Sean, Anna and I have been kind of sharing some notes back and forth here and wondering if as soon as we get done here that maybe we can meet with everybody and let's just really pound this out today because we're running out of time and it would be good to get it done.
A lot of time Sunday, about 3 o'clock.
Gee, does that coincide with anything?
Mr. Chair and good Representatives Olson and Barton have worked on this. It sounds like, you know, we had less than a month to implement what we've already done. Why don't we wait? I mean, till we get some more feedback on what there could be other things. Are we, you know, and I'm really conscious of the concerns that the business, the steel industry was not involved in your earlier discussions, that are we, you know, shouldn't we let what we've done, a lot of work and time went into what we've done, should we make changes to that 60 days after it goes into effect, or wait and see what other things we're going to have to make?
Well,
okay, I'll just reopen the hearing so it's over.
Okay.
I was going to say a little technical.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, there was some constitutional issues that were discovered that needed to be corrected. There were clearly some fixes that needed to be addressed if, in fact, we wanted this law to impact the whole industry, because the way it was written, they were excluded. So that was a piece that needed to get corrected. One of the best changes that we've done has been the driver's license issue with the post office box, because that has been a huge factor for the industry. And I mean, all along we've been wanting to try to be more business friendly here with this bill, and be truthful, this has been a great opportunity to hear where we really want to go with this.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, just to reiterate, there were a few points that I think are absolutely necessary for this law to have its intended effect. As for some of the other ones that we've discussed today, I'm confident we can thresh some of these out immediately after this meeting. I can say, all in all, I've really enjoyed working on this area of law. It's proven more complicated than I ever anticipated, and I have every confidence that we'll be back here in 2011 with yet more fixes that we can't yet anticipate.
Okay, thank you. Okay, now I'll close the hearing. Thank you very much. And we'll open a work session, which we don't expect to move the bill today, but open a work session on House Bill 3634.
Members of the committee, House Bill 3634, you have the dash two amendments in front of you. They address some of the issues that were here the last time. I know Doug Baloup, who's a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, Northwestern School, I guess, is here and probably discuss them.
Bill, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Okay, sure, let me wait.
Thank you.
Where's my other sign up list?
Chair, members of the committee, you should have the dash two amendments in front of you. Doug Baloup from Northwestern School of Law is here. He discussed the amendments the last time. We do not have a fiscal on this yet because we received the amendments this morning. And as you know, even though the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, the bill cannot leave this committee until it has the fiscal impact statement. We discussed this bill the last time. And as I said, Mr. Baloup is here. There's some changes made to the dash one, and they basically start over on page three of the bill, section four. Dash two amendments, right? And you may remember discussions of the last time about parole hearings and post-prison supervision hearings, both at the parole level and at the local level. This separates out the two provisions into separate subsections and gives the victim the right to be heard and notice at both proceedings. We discussed the Morrissey case at the last time. It does not affect Morrissey situations where the person agrees to sanctions. There's no formal proceedings. So, for example, he's called in by his post-prison supervision officer and said, you violated your terms and conditions of supervision. I'm recommending you receive 5 days. You have a right to a hearing. You'll be detained in jail until we have an opportunity to give you a hearing, which could be 10 days from now, and the person oftentimes takes the 5 days. So it would not impact that as far as notice. It does as it relates to other situations. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, going over to the top of page four, and this was an issue that was discussed at the last meeting, on page four, lines three through six, and then following down on lines 23 to 26, in July of 2009, Justice Brewer, in a interlocutory appeal from a parole board hearing, the situation here was the lawyer for the parolee sought victim statements as part of his case in defense, and the parole board said no, that they were excluded under the public records laws. The court, Judge Brewer, disagreed, saying they were not excluded.
and gave the attorney the right to see them with information redacted, and also put an order on the attorney that he could not share that information with his client. Lines 3 through 5 and 23 through 26 would give the board statutory authority to not have to release that information even to the person's attorney. Okay? That was the parole board was seeking that in a separate bill, which they did not file, but what, that issue was taken care of here. That what the board did not address in his opinion, because he was able to decide statutorily grounds with constitutional issues. They'll still be there. Obviously, we can't affect that, but it takes care of the statutory problem. Chairman, members of the committee, going on to the back of the bill, two things on page 19. We have two effective dates here. Certain sections will take effect 60 days after the act, other sections, and that's in section 15, lines 9 through 13. And then in section 16, other sections will take effect upon passage. And then section 15, sub 2, gives the Attorney General's Office, the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, Psychiatric Security Review Board, the authority to promulgate regulations under the statute as it relates to the provisions that affect them. I think, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that those are the differences between the dash 1 and dash 2, but I see Mr. Ballouf just raise his finger, so he may have other issues.
Okay, Mr. Ballouf, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor has everything correct. There's one issue that was controversial in the last hearing, and that was the provision allowing victims to present a psychiatric report of their own. That has been removed from legislation. I emailed all the legislatures to that effect. Otherwise, I think Mr. Taylor is spot on. I would only add that in terms of the constitutional issue for keeping victims' impact statements confidential, the case law in other states is that it is not constitutionally mandated to share that information. I would say that this information is information from a public policy point of view that should be kept confidential. It typically reveals the pain and suffering of a particular victim or the family of a victim, and in parole board cases, we're typically dealing with particularly violent offenders. Once that's released to counsel, there really is no way to keep that confidential in the future, because it's going to be argued in court proceedings. It's going to come out public in the public forums where that kind of information is utilized. So that's all I had to add. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Professor. Representative Barton, excuse me. You have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You have a question?
A question for you, please. Sorry. Apologies. And actually, I wish I could frame this question better. For whatever reason, my notes on the draft I was writing on last time, I have a new draft now. And so
maybe together we can figure it out.
So there were actually, you addressed one point of contention in the last one, i.e. the right to retain a psychologist independently. I believe there was a second point, although it received less attention, that, as I recall, Bronson James brought up about an internal inconsistency between Section A and Section B of one of these. And I'm wondering, A, do you know what I'm talking about? B, what is that? And C, has it been addressed?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that remain of concern. And it could be one of those two things. One is the concern that that the psychiatric records are released to district attorneys and victims. And there's a concern that those records not go beyond those people. In principle, I share the concern that those physical records not be further disseminated. I've spoken with the chair of the parole board, and he believes the way to resolve that particular issue is for the board to meet with people, including myself and the defense bar, and try to figure out a solution. The solution would not be to eliminate the ability of district attorneys and victims to get there. The other issue that might be what you're talking about is this notion that they brought about, which they call parity, the general idea being if the victim gets my psychological reports, we should be able to get the victim's impact statement.
And was that it?
Or am I totally off base here?
No, that's
trying to see if that jogs
your memory. I think this is it.
So I think there are a couple of things. First, I think the notion of parity in the sense they mean it is remarkably flawed in the parole board setting. This isn't a trial where a person is pending conviction, nor is it a sentencing based on a trial and a judgment of conviction. Parole is a privilege of people. It is not a right. And the concern, the public policy balance that was struck by keeping the victim impact statements confidential, and again, these are typically gut-wrenching kinds of letters describing the harm that's befallen victims, was done right the first time. That is, that they should be able to say what they want without sharing their pain and suffering with the defendant or with the public. So that's a public policy decision. I don't think there's any constitutional question that it can be kept confidential. The idea of releasing information to victims and district attorneys, on the other hand, is essential, I think, because these are the people who have an interest in, well, whatever their interest in, is informing a position on the action of the board. And to form that position, they need to be fully informed. There really is no parity in parole board hearings to begin with. To give you an example, I was in a parole board hearing with on a serial murderer, and in that hearing, the defendant presented witnesses for 5 hours. He spoke at length, his attorney spoke at length, and what I was able to do as counsel for the victims is those victims got a very brief period of time to address the parole board, and I was not a person who was permitted to present to the parole board under those rules. So this notion of parity, it is an inquisitorial proceeding, as the director indicated. And I have been loath to break it open into an adversary proceeding. I respect the institutional necessities of the parole board. On the other hand, there are certain minimal accommodations of dignity and respect we need to give victims, and I think one of them is their ability to share their pain without sharing it with the rest of the world, which is inevitably what would happen. You can tell counsel, they can look at it and they can't share it with defendant, but you can't keep counsel from putting in a brief they're going to put before the court. You know, you just can't stop that. So it's a problem, and that's where I come down on it on a public policy point of view.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barton.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I think that there really is one centralized remaining area of concern and dispute amongst us, and that is what to do about disparate treatment in access to board evidence. One thing that's come, that's been disclosed as a result of this bill, really, is a board practice that really, quite frankly, none of us understood was going on. And that is the board currently understands the current statutory phrase that the victim is entitled to access of board information that the board will use in making its determination, that they will actually give physical hard copies of those records to the victim. They will mail them, or they'll make them available to their representative. It could be Mr. Dole or somebody on their behalf. I've spoken with the forensic examiners who actually conduct those evaluations. These are psychiatrists, psychologists who work at the behest of the board to conduct these evaluations. They had no idea that their reports were being handed over in hard copy. It is an ethical requirement of their licensure that they inform the inmate of the degree of confidentiality that inmate can expect from the evaluation. So now being informed of the fact that the victim might get a copy, they feel they have to inform the inmate, not only will a copy of my report be given to the board, but it may or may not be given to the victim, and we have no idea what the victim might do with that hard copy from here on out. They feel that this will impact the candor of their evaluations and the quality of them. So I submit to the committee that this really does require some very cautious determination. I don't know of any other crime victim provision in any other state that requires or sanctions victims getting hard copies of these kind of files. I think we in Oregon would be cutting our teeth with this one, and I think we need to be very cautious about that. Our concern is then, of course, that there is not equal an equal right of the defense to see the victim's letters. So some of these cases are intrafamilial. If the defendant has family members writing letters to the board on the defendant's behalf, the victim would get those copies of those supportive letters. Those may be intrafamilial letters, and yet the defense is not even allowed access, can't even read the victims. So this is what I suggest we do, and I'll be requesting an amendment that does this, is pull out those provisions that relate, that address this issue. The provision, and it is in the original dash one amendment, it was a 4A and a 4B. Pull those out and require that the parole board's work group, it's an existing work group, it look at this issue, it bring this forensic community to the table, let's get their input, they have their own concerns independent of ours, and then let's address this and bring it to the 2011 legislature. The rest of the bill, I think, is uncontentious.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Mr. Maloof.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Question for you, Ms. Myron. First of all, let me preface it by saying I serve on the Parole Board Advisory Committee. To the extent that's something I'm happy to take up in that work. This is an interesting and surprisingly complicated issue. But let me just push back, if I may, on what you describe as an utterly unique attribute here to sharing the, then I suppose, inmate, I'm not sure if that's correct, it would be in parole board, psychological records with the victim. I don't know if is it really as unprecedented or unique as you might suggest. For example, perhaps a crude analogy would be in civil practice if one were a plaintiff in some way, and oftentimes if you're suing to recover for psychological injuries, which is not uncommon in a variety of malpractice, any kind of sex abuse case, for example. The defense in that case, now I admit that's an adversarial as opposed to inquisitorial proceeding, but it's oftentimes if a plaintiff or someone is going to avail themselves of a potential benefit, is it really that unprecedented or unusual for the medical records that are necessary for the plaintiff to avail themselves of that benefit to be shared with other parties? Did that make sense? That was a bit long-winded.
Thank you. Chair Barker and Representative Martin, members of the committee. My understanding in the civil context is that when the plaintiff sues for emotional distress, they waive their rights of confidentiality with respect to prior evaluations and reports and care and treatment relating to their mental health. The parole board considers, that by case law and I think by practice, the parole board considers its records and files exempt from public disclosure. These are not public records. And so the question then becomes, I don't know that this is apples and oranges. These are not public records. And so the question, the current statutory phraseology that's repeated in the bill here would simply say the victim is entitled to access to information. Access to information does not automatically translate to possession of physical hard copy without a showing of need and without any constraint on subsequent secondary use of that information. So, and I think institutionally, as well as just perhaps by way of evidence rules, but institutionally, the forensic community that I spoke with is concerned about this. They think that in advising the inmate, we don't really know where your report's going to go. You know, it doesn't stop with the board. It could be up for discussion in the coffee shop of your hometown. We won't know. They think that that will have an impact. And so I just think these are weighty considerations.
Mr. Chair, thank you. They're unquestionably weighty considerations and also complicated considerations. I look forward to working with whomever to think them through.
And Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meyer, can you think of other, so if the sort of cleavage, if the question rests on the desire, might not be willing to say consensus desire, but the weight of desire to give victims access to information, but the weight of some other desire not to give them hard copies which could be distributed,
I suppose that would also mean electronic copies that could be even more easily distributed. Are there other options in the real world that we can imagine that would give victims information without, while you know, reducing the risk of transmission?
Chair Barker and Representative Smith, I think that's the issue. I think information is distinct from hard data. And I think it would be easy for the board to require that there be a summary written by the examiner. And the summary could be conveyed to the victim. But that's different, perhaps, than the actual totality of their report. Some of the forensic folks that I was speaking with, they were saying, you know, we use really complicated medical terminology, access one, access two diagnoses. We have phraseologies, and those can be very misinterpreted by common folk out on the street. And they don't want to be misunderstood to have said something under their name that perhaps isn't accurate. So, yes, I think information is different from hard copy, and I think this is what we need to explore, how to get that done.
Okay, thank you. And I just would say, as far as the, like, fairness, because the victim gets this and the convict doesn't get the victim's letter, I don't want some of the people who are just nothing but pure evil over there to get a victim's letter to be able to go back to their cell and share it with their cellmates and all have a good laugh at what they did to these victims. So I have a kind of a different opinion about fairness on that issue. Mr. Baloof?
Could I just say something about this? But Chair Barker, we're not suggesting that a physical hard copy of the victim statement would ever get in the hands of the inmate. We're not even really suggesting. Judge Brewer, in his more recent opinion, basically said the defense lawyer could have a copy, but we think it'd be better to say that the defense lawyer or a representative could perhaps read it, but never, we're not suggesting ever that it would be wise to have a hard copy in the hands of the inmate. We don't suggest that.
Yeah. I don't like the idea of the inmate having it either, because some inmates, it wouldn't matter. Others are just really bad people, and it wouldn't make a big difference. Mr. Baloof?
At the core, I think there's no philosophical disagreement about restricting the dissemination of physical copies beyond the people who are necessary to have the information at the hearing. And I think the parole board director is correct in saying that this is a complicated issue, and he's willing to work to bring people together to resolve it. I want to talk briefly about Ms. Meyer's suggestion to redact certain parts of this bill. That the part of the bill she wants to redact is current law that has been law for over 15 years, which has allowed victims access to these records. And I would note that that law was passed by the people rather than the legislature. So I would suggest, if we're moving forward, the way not to move forward is to defy that will of the people today on this bill.
That would require the supermajority vote then?
Well, it's not a constitutional provision.
Okay, right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it requires a supermajority vote if it's a bill lowering a sentence enacted by the people. So I don't think there's a sentence involved here. It would be, if I could ask Professor Baloof, what provision are you talking about in the bill, and when was it enacted by the people?
And I wish I could give you the date, and I've been consulting with Steve Dole on this because I don't have the date, but the provision is the provision that the victims can rely upon the record that the parole board has, get the information that the parole board has.
Page 3.
Thank you. Gail Wines, 27 to 30.
Thank you.
If I might, Chair Barker, page 3, subsection 2C does parrot existing statutory language. It does say that the victim personally or by counsel and the district attorney shall be given access to the information. That does parrot existing statutory language. That's why I'm saying this bill exposed the practice of the board in giving the hard copy, which we did not know was going on. What would be new would be new codification that is not in existing law is on page 4, line 3. Therein it says the board may not disseminate the statements of a victim submitted to the board concerning the offender. That's been by practice, but that's not been codified.
Thank you.
That's correct.
Okay. Any further questions? Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Okay.
Chairman. Aaron Felton, Chairperson, Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I just wanted to at least illustrate some of the current practices at the board in terms of what we do. When previous speaker talked about, used a term like exposing practice at the board, I guess I reacted to that because what we do in terms of providing access to district attorneys and victims' records is something that has been done, well, I think, since Chairperson Washington was. I asked our victims' assistance person, or victim services employee today, and she's been there 20 years at the board, and she's, well, since she called, since Chair Washington was there. That's been several years now. The law requires that we provide access to these records. And you've got to recall that we have people, victims, appear by telephone at these hearings. Many of our victims are in, I just picked out Baker County, for example. They're not all in the valley. They can't all drive down and be shown the records that we have. So I believe we have a burden. And this time, just, you know, I don't have any rules or protocol or diary. I can say this is the reason that we did it. But I was trying to think, well, why do we do this? Well, it seems very sensible that we need to treat victims equally and figure out a way that we can treat someone who is in Baker County, for example, or Umatilla County, and figure out how can we provide and follow the law. And I believe this is the reason it is done, that in order to follow the statute, which is ORS 144-120, paragraph 7, that would provide access. So I believe that is the reason that it is done. And I can't answer the question either as to when that statute was put into effect. And let me sort of respond to the penultimate issue that has been raised. Enough questions have been raised about this information sharing that I'd be happy to go into a process of reconvening the parole hearings work group to evaluate the process. It's always a good idea to look back at your processes and what you're doing, because enough questions have been raised by our stakeholders that in between sessions, or whatever would be appropriate with your direction, we would be happy to evaluate these issues with these folks and come up with perhaps some procedural safeguards, checks, balances, whatever seems appropriate to address some of these issues. Because when Professor Ballouf talked about parity, it's not a matter in the board's perception of choosing one party or individual over another, whether it's the victim or the inmate. It's not about that. What parity comes down to in the board's perspective is we want parity in terms of unfettered information, whether it is the inmate being able to be free to speak to the evaluator so that the board gets a good, clean, strong evaluation that is candid in its content, or whether it's paired in the terms of the victim being good and clean and candid in their impressions and sharing the information to us. That is what we want. That is the parity we seek. So perhaps I would disagree with Professor Ballouf on that one point. So I would be happy to consider that with this this committee's direction, or the entire body's direction in that regard. So I hope I've at least addressed some of the concerns, because I fear that the impression was being left that the board is out sort of willy-nilly sending things out in terms of what is very, very personal information, whether it was the victim or whether it was the inmate. We take very serious our role in guarding people's confidences.
Okay, well, thank you, and appreciate your willingness to go back to do some more work. Go ahead, Representative Tomei.
Quick question. So are you saying that when people are out of town that you do email or fax or send them psychological evaluations or psychiatric evaluations?
We do. Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei. The psychologicals that we send, let me preface by saying these are forensic psychologicals, the evaluations that are created at the request of the board pursuant to statute. They are not psychologicals that may have been done independently or as a over the course of their stay with the Department of Corrections or another forum. They are prepared pursuant to statute in preparation for a parole hearing. Incidentally, we do close to 200 of these a year. Not all of them have attorneys with them or other representatives. But when that is done pursuant to these statutes, and they know they're having a parole hearing, so it shouldn't be a surprise, and many of them have had two, three, or four of these psychologicals done. Yes, if they ask in a timely fashion, we will send those to them, and more recently, we have begun emailing them to people.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any question, Representative, Council?
Chair, members of the committee, these psychological evaluations you're talking about, Mr. Felton, are they subject to disclosure under the public records laws?
Mr. Chairman,
Could I make a request for them under the public records laws?
I have not, Mr. Chairman, Council Taylor, I have not had the opportunity to evaluate that question. I believe you could make a request of that. Yes. I don't know how I'd respond to that.
Okay. Why, Council, Mr. Chair, if I may, Council Taylor, I think you're right. Why wouldn't they be?
Yeah.
It's presumed public record unless it's explicitly in the two chapters.
Right. Yeah. I believe.
Why wouldn't it be?
Let me answer you this way. Everything is a public record unless there's an exception that says it's not. So I would first look to see, because again, in my responsibility to keep those be respectful of the confidences, I would look to see whether there was an exception that would apply to that. Because I'm reluctant to hand those out except for these very narrow exceptions which apply to victims, district attorneys, and others involved in the process. But I believe they are public records. Unless an exception would apply or exclusion from the law applies.
Would those be medical records, though? Wouldn't they be?
Yeah, could we find out?
We can check, because we're not going to move this bill today or the amendment. So,
let's guess.
Thank you very much.
I can tell you. I believe. Have I answered your question, sir?
Can I just ask a quick follow-up? So then, theoretically, if you send this to a victim by email or fax or whatever. We were talking earlier about this being discussed at the local coffee shop. Not only that, it could be printed in the local newspaper, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, unfortunately, that is correct. There are not limitations. I have the board has no ability to issue, as I said, a protective order or hold them confidential or do what a judge has, for example, if someone violates a protective order, impose sanctions. We have no authority to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, but this has been the practice in the past, and so we have the one case we know of where somebody's eval went out on the internet.
Mr. Chairman, I've heard of that. It's been anecdotally put out there. I have not personally. I don't know which case that was. I have just heard of that happening.
I suppose the Gilmore's, but I don't.
Well, but it is not impossible for that to happen.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions today? Thank you very much, Mr. Felton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we will carry over House Bill 3670, 3695, and 3601.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just draw the committee's attention to 192, ORS 192.496, regarding the public availability of medical records of living individuals.
They are available or not?
I haven't read it all. This is pretty quick, but I'm going to take a harder look at that, but I suspect perhaps not.
We'll appreciate your feedback on that. Thank you. No further business before the committee today. Meeting adjourned.